Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 10th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are two of my colleagues, Jamie Gray and Catherine Reed. On our program this week, an NPR ProPublica investigation into hundreds of millions of dollars given to the Red Cross to build houses in earthquake-ravaged Haiti. Why is it only six were ever built? A report from the Women's Media Center indicates the gender gap is widening in most U.S. newsrooms. Why that? And the impact that it's having on the quality of our reporting. And employees have cast their ballots, and it's at about a 3-to-1 margin at Gawker to unionize. What will life likely look like there under a collective bargaining agreement? We'll talk about it. There's a whole lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well, but we're going to start with those two specials on the Kelly File on Fox News Channel, the ones in which the Duggar family spoke out. They were some of the highest rated episodes of Megyn Kelly's nightly interview program. More than 2.2 million viewers tuned in for the second installment Friday night when Duggar daughters Jessa Seewald and Jill Dillard identified themselves as two of their brother's victims. Here they are telling Kelly about their initial reaction to the police reports being made public.
It was whenever I heard the police report had been released that I said, what? Like, they don't have a right to do this. This isn't, we're victims. They can't do this to us.
And yet they did.
And they did.
If one thing was clear watching the half-hour interview, it wasn't their brother Josh they felt victimized by.
We see the tears. What was it? I mean, what was it about the disclosure that was so painful?
Well, I see it as a re-victimization that's even 1,000 times worse.
Why?
Because this is something that was already dealt with. We've already forgiven Josh. We've already moved on.
Is it humiliating, or what is the emotion that you're feeling?
Well, it's not the truth, first of all. Everything was distorted. And so we felt like our story was not being told. And we felt like it shouldn't have been told.
These women have said over and over again, these two sisters, two of the five who were part of the investigation, that this was a family problem. It was something that had been dealt with. There had been healing. There had been forgiveness. The fact that this came up in the media again, they viewed it as a re-victimization. Is it?
I think you always have to look at who's a victim in certain cases, and it, particularly when you're talking about incidents like we are in this that are sexual abuse allegations. When you go to those levels, you really have to consider even more so who you're identifying. And I do think, you know, a lot of times you can get victim names out of court records, but you choose not to publish them. And that happens a lot at every publication, I think. And in this case, I think more questions needed to be asked on the front end. Is this okay? And when you read the police report, it's very clear that the victims were relatives of his right from the get-go.
Yes. And ordinarily, we wouldn't report on that. But one of the things that's different about this, well, there's several things that are different about this case. The number one thing is it's the Duggars. It's a celebrity slash trauma case. And these are handled really differently. It's like all the rules are suspended. And remember the Madeleine McCann kidnapping case in Portugal? One of the things that the Leveson Inquiry revealed was that the Portuguese police had turned over to the British media I believe it was Madeleine's mother's journal. And that's how the media dug up this story that some Brits still believe is true, that the McCanns in financial desperation had sold their daughter to, you know, human slavery market or some crazy story. It's clear to me that in certain cases, people behave completely differently in what rules of conduct they follow. And it seems to me that there was some motivation here in allowing these records to get out. Now, Arkansas has got a really strong Freedom of Information Act, but still there's a question about whether or not it was legal for them to release these records.
And there have been some conflicting opinions coming out on this, mm-hmm. both from lawyers and experts both in the state of Arkansas and those outside that were saying, and the family saying, that this release, because of the status as minors of both Josh Duggar and the five victims at the time, these never should have been released.
It's really surprising. In my experience, and I've been covering public safety issues and sexual assault for a really long time, authorities will err on the side of caution. They don't err on the side of, oh, this is probably okay under the Sunshine Law. It goes the other way. And so that raises this question for me about, you know, why did this happen in this case? How did this happen? Somebody was really eager to see this family be exposed for, I suppose, what was being perceived as a hypocrisy in their, you know, wholesome family values, public persona.
Well, and even a long time before this came out this time, when they had appeared on Oprah, somebody had faxed, I believe it was faxing, into the Oprah show. And this was well before their show, however, the, what was it, 17 Kids and Counting when it first started. And were kind of warning of this. And so it was already, the rumors were there.
And Oprah's producers had gone ahead and reported it and actually pulled back on that segment and didn't have the Duggars on there. It's interesting, though. I had heard something on CNN, I believe it was Monday night. Don Lemon was saying that on the heels, one of my favorites.
Your favorite.
Yes, Jane's looking at me. We both say that tongue in cheek. I suppose if you're listening to this on the radio, you're not hearing that part. Don Lemon had stated that on the heels of the In Touch magazine report, CNN had also filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the same documents In Touch had already published and had that request denied. Interestingly enough, there's a piece that we've put on our links blog from the Washington Post taking a look at some of the background of how this story came together. And this story was characterized as some hardcore quality investigative journalism in terms of process beginning to end.
Sure. And those elements are there. But sometimes you spend a lot of time looking for something and you find it. And then there's the question after that of, do you publish it? Right. And what do you do with that information? We've had cases here in Missouri very recently where there has been a victim that people maybe knew the name of, that reporters knew the name of, and chose not to publish for a long time until the victim, until the victims came out. I'm talking about the Speaker John Deal story, where the, I don't want to say victim, but the intern in that situation was kept protected. So we have these scenarios where you as a journalist know the information and maybe you've done all this, but do you go as far as to make it obvious that some of the victims are his sisters? And I think to me, that's the distinction, is that you've now identified, I mean, there's only so many women, girls at the time that this could have been, and that's what they disclosed. And I don't think that that was responsible off the top.
Right. I mean, no. I mean, you just don't do it. We often don't report on inter-family sexual abuse cases for exactly that reason.
Because if somebody is arrested, if there's charges, that address becomes public and you've immediately identified.
Yeah, there's several different ways you can inadvertently disclose the identity of the victims. And it happened here in a case in Columbia with an incest victim. And, you know, it was painful for this young woman and for her younger sister. So it's an ethical question at that point. And, you know, what is the purpose of our reporting? We always have to stop and ask ourselves that question. Does this kind of reporting on incest, sexual abuse in family, is this of benefit to anyone? And I just don't see this having a benefit.
There have been some arguments on blogs that this has opened the door to have conversations about incest, about sexual abuse victims staying silent, about the reporting of sexual abuse instances. In this particular case, I've seen some interesting work done on homeschool reporting rates versus public and private school reporting rates. So,
Because a child who may be told to go to a teacher or a principal or another trusted adult and might not have the same access to those trusted adults as students who are in a regular public or private school setting.
So I have seen some interesting discussion come out of it, but should it have come at the cost of these women being re-victimized years later?
Right. That, and that's the part of this, in reading it very closely, that really bothered me. That there was never this sense of there being any external support for these girls, that it was a family friend and someone that someone had a professional relationship with in the family. None of this, I mean, there it didn't sound by the book to me at all. And so that is a good point, that there might be some value there, but you know, it seems to me that there's a way to report on those issues that is not at the expense of two victims.
A lot of people were looking forward to those interviews to see what the Duggars would say, how Jim, Bob, and Michelle would speak of their son's actions and how they responded on behalf of their daughters. A lot of them, myself included, hoped that they'd be able to walk away from watching those programs feeling like the girls had someone looking out for them. But that really wasn't going to be the case. The morning after Jim, Bob, and Michelle's segment, which aired last Wednesday evening, Whoopi Goldberg came right out on The View and called their staunch defense of their son hypocritical.
I know this is your son, and I know that you're trying, and this was many years ago, but don't downplay this, especially after what you guys have done in the name of Christianity and God to other people. I'm just saying, that's just my feeling.
That was part of the Hot Topics segment, and we just listened to a short part of it. It went on about a minute and a half in total. There were times when child actor Raven Simone nodded, and Nicole Wallace, a former George W. Bush communications director, shouted, "Preach." The media backlash. Any surprises here, do you think?
No, I mean, when you think about how networks have handled incidents in the past, the Honey Boo Boo incident comes to mind, you know, of when they pull shows like this. And then media backlash, I mean, you're going to have people that are going to come on both sides of this. And I read an interesting article that basically said, if you liked the Duggars and what they stood for before, then you still like them after the interviews. If you didn't and you were questioning how you felt about the family, these were probably going to be make
going
you feel
to reinforce
about
those
yeah
so
feelings.
Okay. Well, a couple of weeks ago, Mike and Ernest and I were talking about journalists who gave donations to the Clinton Foundation, specifically Judy Woodruff, and the $250 she donated to the Haiti Relief Fund following the devastating earthquake there in 2010. When we were debating where and how journalists can lend their personal support during times of international crisis, Ernest said the Red Cross, some kind of apolitical group, is potentially the only safe option. Those words rang in my ears as I drove home last week and heard the 19-minute investigation from NPR and ProPublica that ran during All Things Considered. Here's the lead. The American Red Cross spent 5 years and almost half a billion, with a B, dollars in Haiti to build 6 homes. We often say that the best investigative reporting comes when you follow the money. A half a billion dollars. How'd they come upon this?
I think it's still a little bit unclear. They talk about a lot of internal emails and internal documents. And in what I've found looking online, I still can't exactly tell. Did someone leak these documents out? Did they, you know, how many of these were done through public records requests and all of the tax forms that get filed? I'm still not exactly clear where they were able to get the start.
It sounded to me as if a lot of the documents were actually posted on the Red Cross, the American Red Cross website. And then, of course, working with ProPublica and NPR together have done some really great reporting just in general on funding for disaster relief. So, you know, they've gotten it some answers through interviews. But I think the most exciting and interesting part of this reporting is just the shoe leather reporting part of it, that they went there and they spoke to people and they found out that so much of what the Red Cross has said it had accomplished in Haiti had not been accomplished. So it's just a kind of a reminder to all of us, and I'm sure we say this to our students all the time, go see, mm-hmm. go have a look. Don't take anybody's word for it.
And even taking the brochures there to the people and mm-hmm. showing them. I thought that was a remarkable part of it.
Right.
So much of it was just hitting the ground.
And I think one of the most striking sentences in the story, too, was we took the brochure, we showed it to them, several asked us if we could keep it.
Yes.
Because they were so surprised living this for five
right.
years.
Right.
The Red Cross has issued a statement, which you can also read mm-hmm. from our Links blog, calling this a slam job, that it's one-sided, it's biased, it isn't right. providing the perspective that the Red Cross brought to the interviews. I'm going to ask both of you, very experienced reporters and investigators, your opinion. Did this feel one-sided or biased to you, or did you feel like the Red Cross had an opportunity to provide a perspective in it?
Yes. They were given many opportunities to answer questions and to be more specific. And this was where I saw a failure. There wasn't specificity. And when reporters get sort of broad answers that lack specificity, mm-hmm. I mean, it has a tendency to make us want to dig even mm-hmm. more deeply. And this isn't the first go-round for NPR / ProPublica and the Red Cross, and not the first time that the Red Cross has said, this story wasn't fair to us, it's incorrect. And NPR and ProPublica have been very transparent in responding to those allegations of errors, and there haven't been egregious errors. There have been little areas of disagreement. But, you know, it's really disturbing to me, and it concerns me a lot because, you know, I'm one of the many people who wrote a check to the Red Cross. Admittedly, Haiti is a really tough place to provide disaster relief, and I had sort of a sixth row seat to some of that because of a volunteer job that I had right after the earthquake and listening to the conversations between the aid organizations in Haiti, and it's really hard. But some organizations that have been there longer, Partners in Health, for example, mm-hmm. they have been really successful. They're very well known. It sounds to me that this outsourcing problem, or it's not problem, the fact that the Red Cross outsourced so much of its work, and didn't have the language skills on the ground, you know, that's something for the Red Cross organization to look at and try to figure out. What do we have to do to be better project managers of all this money? Because this is just shocking.
I think there are a lot of instances where you'll have a source come back and say that you've cherry picked mm-hmm. out of the interviews, and maybe that you've only chosen certain bites or quotes that fit into the narrative that you were trying to tell. However, in this case, what I see, and obviously we don't have transcripts of, mm-hmm. of entire interviews, so
right.
we don't know, you know, but there is what I think in this article, in this story on NPR, is really good what we call process writing. They very much explain mm-hmm. what they did through their reporting. And that, for me, as a news consumer, and also what I teach my students to do, it really kind of helps you tell the story and helps your listeners understand how you got your information and lets the listener decide, do I have the full story?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to guess just as many people who caught that piece on the air actually caught it via podcast. Like I know I did through one of the NPR Story of the Day podcasts that I subscribe to, or on NPR One, maybe saw it on Facebook or Twitter and clicked on a link that way. I'm going to guess just as many people consume this online as ended up hearing it on the radio. So I'm also going to guess that NPR knows exactly to the number how many people consumed it that way. And I'm also going to guess that those numbers are going to be communicated to the reporters and editors who worked on it. Well, as of this week, that process of sharing those numbers is now the standard operating procedure at the New York Times and the Washington Post. Reporters have daily access to the web metrics on their stories. They're going to know exactly how many people clicked, where they came from online, and how long they stayed there. As a former homepage editor at the Chicago Tribune, my entire day was completely consumed by metrics, understanding what was going on and what audiences' behaviors were. But I'm interested in asking the two of you guys. Catherine is a city editor at the Columbia Missourian. Jamie is an investigative reporter and managing editor at KOMU. How do web analytics affect the jobs that you're doing and your reporters are doing on a daily basis?
We have ours posted right up on the wall all day long. You can look up at any point and see who's on what story, right, where they came from, how they got there, what search terms they might have entered. So it's a big part of what we do. And in other stations where I've worked, it was also not up on the wall always, although my last station eventually moved in that direction, but we all had access to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do too. We have Chartbeat mm-hmm. on the wall of our newsroom, and you know, we look at it and we're interested in most read. But your question is, you know, how does it, if the question is, how does it affect our reporting? Yeah. You know, that's an area of tension. It, you know, do we all start, you know, posting kitten videos and
no pun intended, do you let the tail wag the dog?
Right. That's right. I mean, I think that's an area where we're still really, there's a push and a pull mm-hmm. and it's hard to resist in some ways. I mean, you know that if you do certain kinds of stories, people are really going to consume them and they're going to spend a lot of time with them. And then you also know that there are certain things you feel you have to report on. So I think the most important thing is just having a dynamic conversation about it in your newsroom. I would hate to think, and I know this, and you know, it happens all the time, yeah, that a person is creating, people are creating content just for clicks. Of course they are.
But I've told the stories I'm not so proud of when I had been pressured to do just mm-hmm. that, because right. page views matter.
Yes.
Clicky headlines and all of those different things.
Someone you know died. I was once told that was the best headline I could ever put out there.
Wow.
Somebody would want to know
wow.
who it was that died oh, and right. would click on
wow.
that. So let me ask you this. As a coach, as a professor, as an editor, how do you go about convincing your students who are about to become those journalists going out into the world where they may get that daily metrics report, not to place their value as a journalist on the number of people who click on their story?
I think it's a matter of standing up for yourself when you're in those scenarios. If something doesn't feel right to you, it's your responsibility as a journalist to go let your editors know, your managers know, in a way. And I think that's what we try and teach here, is give every student a good ethical foundation mm-hmm. so that they will then bring that into the next newsroom when they are. And hopefully rise up when the occasion may happen, and also hopefully help guide some of those principles and talk about, you know, what we try to do here. Are we right every time? No, of course not. We have the conversations, but at least it prepares them to have a conversation, which is, I think, one of the biggest benefits of how we teach here.
Right. It's that ethical grounding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I believe that if you write a wonderful story, a really strong story, people are going to share it. And
they're going to find it, and they're going to
Well, show I think that we have a, you know, we have to, I just had this conversation with my students yesterday, mm-hmm. you know, that we are responsible for finding our own audience now for our work. We have to become much more active in that role. And the audience isn't going to just sort of wander up to our door and go, what do you have today? It's just not the way people are consuming news. They're not, very few people or smaller numbers of people are going to a homepage and going, what do you have for me today? Like, you know, this is a cafeteria. I'm going to pick certain things from only your line. And so we have to find audiences for our work. And if we're writing stories that are smart and engaging and well-written and authoritative, funny, uplifting, you know, all of those things that journalism can be, people are going to share it. And so you sort of reach the same endpoint, don't you?
Yeah. And you don't have to have, you'll never believe what happens next.
Right.
I hate that one on Facebook.
Your mind will be blown. So it's very rare that both Mike and Ernest are both gone. And I'm going to admit, when I asked the two of you to sit in here with me today, I had an ulterior motive in doing that. I wanted there to be three women sitting at this table to discuss this next topic, the Women's Media Center's annual report about the state of women in the media. It's out and it's not good. They did a at least from where I sit, and I'm guessing the two of you as well. They did a content analysis of nearly 28,000 pieces of content produced last year and found that just a bit more than 62% was produced by men. Evening newscasts had women on them only 32% of the time. Only 37% of print stories were reported by women, and only 38% carried a female byline. The biggest beat that had disparities there. The biggest disparity in the beat system was in politics. Mm-hmm. And it's alarming to me, at least, as we head into the 2016 election cycle, how few female voices there are as part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's reflective of the topic being covered. Look at the field of politicians. It is a male-dominated field. Look at sports. There's also a big thing about the number of female sports journalists on the decline. The amount of coverage that women's sports gets is also less than. So I think in some way it can be reflective of what is being covered, who you're going out there and covering. I, for one, I was a Capitol correspondent in Idaho, and I think we actually started to get that balance to shake about 50-50 by the time that I left. And I thought that was fantastic. I mean, we had a lot of women who were working with the press club on issues in politics and very active in the Capitol. So I think it depends on where you are. And those articles have acknowledged that.
Well, it's sort of a chicken and an egg argument, though, isn't it? I mean, the coverage isn't going to change until there are more right. women making decisions about what
Absolutely.
Gets covered. You know, if there were more women in sports journalism and if there were more women in leadership positions in newsrooms, we would certainly see an influence on what got covered, the kinds of questions that get asked, the way stories mm-hmm. are framed. I mean, this goes way back, but I remember having a really, really heated debate with the male-dominant management of a mm-hmm. newspaper I worked for the day after Princess Diana died in the crash in Paris, because we had literally stopped the presses to make over the front page, knowing this was going to be really big news. The mm-hmm. next day, we were in I'll never forget this meeting where the men were sitting around going, what were you thinking? How could you have possibly done this? We said this was a really, mm-hmm. really important story to women in the United States. Diana was a real
icon.
She was an icon. And I remember there was somebody in the meeting said, guys, I just want to let you know that we sold out and had to print more. I mean, you know, it was a hugely, hugely important story, and people yeah. wanted to keep that paper.
And we should match it because, I mean, especially in local television, women are our audience. So we should be able to match that and give our viewers the type of coverage that they're seeking.
Right. And women are on the internet more than men seeking news, too, according to the report. I think part of this is going to have to get down to more family-friendly newsrooms, more family-friendly mm-hmm. policies mm-hmm. in news organizations, because women are looking for a life-work balance, are going to be more interested in working at places that have one. And I think that's part of the problem.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock and realizing we are likely to run out of time well before we get to two of the other subjects that we were hoping to talk to you about this week. So I want to invite you to stop by our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. If you go there, you're going to find more information on the outcome of the union vote at Gawker Media. That union representation did pass, and editorial employees are going to be represented by the Writers Guild of America. So there's some interesting talk there on what life might look like in that newsroom following that vote. There's also some information about some new crowdsourcing apps for breaking news. So go ahead and check out that links blog. You're also going to want to keep an eye under the programs tab at programs tab on KBIA.org. You will find this show again if you want to watch or listen to it there. I also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Views on KBIA. We look forward to joining you again next week. Jamie will be here with me, and we will talk about what's new on the media there. Thanks for joining us. We'll be with you again next week.
Lady Takeover.
Yes. Lady.